time now for hour number two of our big two-hour weekend get-together here on Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison with you here in the anchor chair. And, of course, the program is hosted by Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. And Carol will be speaking with two people in this hour, and will also be joined this hour by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard Neer will be talking with Dr. Michael Samuels, co-founder and director of Arts as a Healing Force, and a person who has introduced skills for family members who have no training to become artists and healers for their loved ones. Should be a very interesting conversation. And Carol Marks will be talking with Senator Ember Reichgott-Young, former Minnesota State Senator, author of Minnesota's 1991 First Nation Charter School Law, winner of a number of awards, and she's written a book, Zero Chance of Passage, The Pioneering Charter School Story, published by Beavers Pond Press. So we have a pretty interesting hour coming your way. Richard and I are also going to be talking a bit about how we change our tastes and our sentimentality during the holiday season, our tastes in movies, our tastes in music and popular culture. Should be interesting. Let's jump right in now with Carol Marks in conversation with Sarah Wheeler. Sarah Wheeler is the author of 8 books of biography and travel, and she's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled Oh My America, 6 Women and Their Second Acts in a New World. It's published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux.
What made you anxious about turning 50 and want to find some British role models who were able to reinvent themselves?
Well, I had to state my notice, Carol, that women after post-fertility, post-50, tend to be slightly invisible and certainly unfashionable, and nobody writes about them. And I felt as I was approaching that age myself slightly consigned to some sort of shadowy graveyard where my role was only to look after other people and so on. And when I discovered Fanny Trollope, the novelist Anthony's mother, who had gone to America when she was 50, in 1827, when you say your country was younger, but it was really young, and went to Cincinnati to try her hand earning money from her family. It was such an inspiring story. I was drawn to it, and I thought I'd like to read more about this type of thing, and particularly as America is so associated in Europe with second acts and reinvention and the promised land. And looking back now, it seems like the 5 other women dropped out of the sky onto my desk, but of course they didn't know. We're sort of looking for them. We're looking for stories within that 50-year period between 1827 and 1877, because my book stops when the railways join the country together. And America was preparing to become, for the American century, the 20th one. But I was most interested in its embryonic period, where it was forming itself, and all these women went. People were very, very defensive, because they still felt that the old country, as they thought of Britain, was looking down on them and that they didn't have any self-respect. And so they were very much proving themselves and showing.
And that's
that
true.
They were,
and you know,
equal to.
When Fanny Trollope then, okay, wrote her book, Domestic Manners of the Americans, that must have really upset a lot of the Americans, because she thought we had dreadful manners. Dreadful.
Yes, it did. It was front page news on every newspaper in America, which then meant every newspaper about as far as Cincinnati, because America didn't go much further than that in those days. And everybody was very, very upset with her judgments. She was a reactionary in many senses, but a conservative in others. And she was brought up in Georgian England, so she was used to hierarchies. And when she got to America, She found a society in which everybody was equal. So her servant girl was equal to her. And I suppose, let's be forgiving towards her, it was natural enough with her upbringing, but she didn't like it very much. But that was basically, in her book, Domestic Matters of the Americans, which, as you say, caused a huge upset, her main complaint, really, was that everybody was equal, which to us these days makes America seem like a very attractive place compared to the rigid hierarchies of Europe that she was used to. But she certainly wasn't reactionary or liberal enough to be able to accept it. And in her book, Domestic Matters of the Americans, she rails very much against the lack of hierarchy. Now, you might say the way things have panned out, but actually the creation of a new society and the levelling of classes and the democratic instinct that was born then has come good. I would certainly say that. And I think that she probably would as well if she were with us now and could come back and take a view.
Now, there was another book that made a big difference that was written by a very glamorous actress, Fanny Campbell Butler, who came to America to play Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. And she met a very wealthy man and went to live on his plantation, and it led to her writing at 52 the most vivid portrayal of slavery. And do you think that that influenced England not to support the Confederacy in the Civil War, that it had a purpose perhaps which she didn't know about?
Well, I do think that, and also she did know about it, and that's partly why she wrote the book. She very much wanted to support the Yankee cause, because having lived, as you say, on her husband's slave plantations, two plantations in the Georgia Sea Islands, she'd experienced slavery, and it wasn't Tara, I can tell you, down there. And she very much wanted Britain to support the Yankees in order to bring about the abolition of slavery. That was her motive in writing the book, so in a way that was her second act. And I do think that she actually did influence public opinion, because people in Britain, they weren't very interested in America before the Civil War. Even with independence, it was just yet another dependency. And they weren't that interested in it. By the time the Civil War came, they were crucially involved in the cotton trade, desperately needed raw materials for all the manufacturing plants in the north of England. And so they were suddenly, public opinion was ignited. And the newspapers, night and day, half of them, as in America, half of them were allied with the North and half of them were allied with the South. And Fanny Campbell thought it was her turn to speak because she had witnessed slavery in its most hideous forms, and she thought it was time to speak out. So she wrote her book, which to my mind is a more vivid portrayal of America than Domestic Matters of the Americans, because Fanny Campbell wasn't hidebound by anything except what she saw. And she just does write about the individual slaves that she knew, or those rice and cotton plantations in Georgia, you know, individually giving them names and so on. And it really brings it all to life. And to my mind, a very, very powerful book. And if you go to the Georgia Sea Islands, there's a big sign on where her plantation, Butler's plantation, used to be. And it says Southern historians still think that Fanny Campbell was partly responsible for losing the Civil War. So in America, certainly, it's felt that she was, her work was extremely influential, and good for her.
Good for her, and we really haven't heard that much about it. Now, when you were tracking the women in the story, I think it was really great that you had two maps, and what was the difference between the two maps, and was it disconcerting to find that so many things were no longer there? Because, you know, America loves to tear things down instead of preserving them.
Well, yes, I had two maps, one in the 1820s and one around Magnalia of today. And in fact, when I started out, I was worried that I wouldn't find anything that was similar to what it was then. But in fact, there are huge tracts of America, as you know, that haven't changed, that are still wilderness. I mean, going up the Mississippi, for example, where Fanny Trollope sailed up in a steamboat, I was travelling in a little car on the roads, on the tiny little levee roads, extremely quiet, an awful lot of undeveloped land, a lot of landscape, which is exactly what she would have seen. And similarly in Georgia, if you go to those, you know, those sort of amphibious lands on the coast, which are sort of half land and half sea sinking down in, there's an awful lot that's not developed. And I could read her descriptions, Fanny Campbell's descriptions of the landscape, and see exactly the same thing. And it was the same for all of my girls. You know, there were parts of their journeys where one saw the American landscape exactly as they had seen it. Catherine Hubbard, for example, the last one in my book, in California in the 1870s, it was just when exploration of landscape had become fashionable in America, where Americans suddenly saw that the land was wonderful and to be looked at rather than just tamed. The idiots shot and moved off. And Yosemite and the Cascades and volcanoes in the Lassen Park. Certainly there today, you read Catherine Hubbard's Letters Home. It's exactly the same, and I find that quite uplifting because we do have the idea that everything's been wrecked and concretized and all the rest of it. But in fact, there's a lot of America I found which still is wilderness and jolly good too.
Well, that kind of warms my heart. Now, as I said to you before I went on the air, I am never going to complain again because the women that you write about experienced unbelievable physical hardships, and they just carried on. And one was the pioneer homesteader, Rebecca Berlin, who had 7 children and trying with her husband to make a living off the land. I was so moved. They were so poor, they had to wear the same clothes for a year, and they didn't have any way to plow the land, and they did it by hand. I mean, that is, you know, it's even hard to picture that.
Yeah, extraordinary. She was one of many, Rebecca, poor Europeans who thought they had a chance in a new land where they were given land. And she did have this small tract of land in western Illinois. And they went on the steamer up the Mississippi and then took another steamer down the Ohio. And then when they finally got off, she had 5 children with her at that point. And they got off and they sat down. It was nighttime and there was nothing but land all around them. And she said, "Is this America?" And they all burst into tears. And for 2 years, she and her husband worked their small plot of land, ploughing literally by hand. And even in the winter, when snow was at its hardest, she wrote that she would lean against the door lintel and look out and marvel at how wonderful it all was. And the hardships that she went through, and pretty much nothing to feed anybody on except flour, for quite a long time, making patties over a fire with flour, and almost extraordinary hardship. And every 2 weeks, her husband would walk the 5 miles to the store and exchange a bushel of whatever it is they'd grown for a pair of shoes or a tin plate or some coffee, and he'd walk back again, and they would just carry on. And her spirit never wavered. And as you say, when I think about the things I moan about day and night, she kept going, and there are many, many Berlins in western Illinois prospering today.
And she did prosper.
What she went through, and that was really, they were the Europeans that made America, and I wanted there to be a homesteader in my book.
That's Sarah Wheeler in conversation with Carol Marx. Her book is titled Oh My America, 6 Women and Their Second Acts in a New World, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Richard Neer joins us in conversation with Dr. Michael Samuels, talking about healing through the arts. Very interesting. That's next, when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare, and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and I want to remind you, if you want to know more about the adventures of Carol Marks, if you want to know more about resources that can help you through life, and you want to hear some of our better shows over the years that go back many, many years, and the archives, well, you can go to our website. It's atouchofgray.com, and gray is spelled with an E. It's atouchofgray.com. Check it out. Okay, let's move along now to Richard Neer, our senior correspondent, in conversation with Dr. Michael Samuels. He's co-founder and director of Arts as a Healing Force, and he introduced skills for family members who have no training to become artists and healers for their loved ones. He's going to discuss his new book with Richard. It's titled Healing with the Arts, a 12-week program to heal yourself and your community. It's published by Beyond Words, Atria.
Very interesting, Doctor. This is really written almost more for the, in fact, more for the caregiver than for the actual Alzheimer's patient, correct?
It's both. It depends on, no, the book, our book is for everyone. It's for the patient, it's for the caregiver, it's for anyone interested in the immense new power of healing with the arts.
And, but the patient themselves, I mean, usually, depending on the how far advanced the Alzheimer's has, they're not really going to retain this. So really, I would say that the focus has to be on the caregiver, no?
For the book itself, reading the book. But the process that we put in the book, which is doing art with your loved one, your grandmother, your father, a friend with Alzheimer's, is for the person themselves. The person makes art. All you need to do is bring a favorite song on a iPod, a tape, a CD, and play it with an Alzheimer's patient, and their life completely changes. It restructures their memory.
I certainly can testify to the efficacy of that, because my mother, who just recently passed with Alzheimer's, was a big Frank Sinatra fan. And
right.
Whenever my brother would visit her, and he would bring a CD of Frank Sinatra,
right,
she lit up and would tap her feet and would even sing some of the lyrics. So it does
exactly.
work.
Exactly. Yeah, the way it works now, they know pretty well neurologically, is that the Alzheimer's affects the parietal lobe and hippocampus. And that's where the memory, a lot of memory is held. But when you listen to music or paint or make art or write a journal or anything like that, there are other areas of the brain, the auditory area, the visual area, the movement areas are affected. And these areas are not affected by Alzheimer's. So the memory returns, and it actually forms new neurological circuits which stay. So the person not only is better for the moment, but it actually helps build memory and restructure memory for them.
And the good thing, too, on the caregiver's side is it's so frustrating. You can't get through. Sometimes
right.
the patient doesn't even know who you are. This, I don't want to call it babysitting, but it does really kind of open up a means of communication that might not be open otherwise, doesn't it?
It's a deep social bond. It's one of the things we say in our book, Healing with the Arts, is that when you make art with someone, it creates relationship. And of course, with your Alzheimer's loved one, you have a relationship, but the relationship has been interrupted. And when you make art with them, it's, if they paint, you can talk about the content of the painting, or when they have a favorite Frank Sinatra song. They may even remember their first kiss or something like that. And they talk to you suddenly, and the relationship is brought back to life. So the lack of the frustration that a caregiver has for an Alzheimer's patient is changed into love and changed into participation.
Now, is it possible to explore new areas of the arts with them, or is it pretty much things that they had done before? In other words, if the patient was a painter or was into music, they can't all of a sudden become a poet, can they?
It depends completely on the place, the stage of Alzheimer's that the person is at. If they're early Alzheimer's, they can really do anything. And we bring art supplies to people with Alzheimer's. You just bring basically, you can eat colored pencils or crayons or paper. And then you can ask them to draw a memory or ask them to draw something they love or ask them to draw a bird. And then it just starts. The brain is, our brains are hardwired to be creative. And they're hardwired to be creative in a healing way when it's done for that purpose. So really any of the arts. Right now the Alzheimer's Associations advise all arts. They advise music, poetry, visual arts, and they have tips for people on how to do this, which are actually so simple, they're almost not tips. Basically, you just play the music and give them materials and talk to them, and the process takes place by itself. And
now this clearly improves the quality of life. Can it actually prolong the life? In other words, is there any kind of healing going on here, or is it just mostly quality of life?
Well, quality of life is super important, as you know. It's not
exactly
something I know, and because art and healing, the book is how to use all the arts, which is music, dance, visual arts, and word, with yourself, others, community, and the earth. And when you're doing it with an Alzheimer's patient, you're doing it with others. But it's a broad way to cover everything, and it's very special.
Dr. Michael Samuels in conversation with Richard Neer. His book is titled Healing with the Arts, a 12-week program to heal yourself and your community, published by Beyond Words, Atria. I'm Michael Harrison. We got more Touch of Grey coming your way in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined now, as is customary, by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, holidays are in the air. Here we are in the final half hour of this weekend's two-hour installment of A Touch of Gray. What are some of the things that you have been thinking about in that fertile brain of yours?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There seem to be movies that we only watch in the month of December, movies about the holidays or that evoke the holidays. And I'm wondering if your family has any traditions that you sit down and you watch certain things every year at this festive time.
I actually have traditions where I watch certain things all the time, whenever I can, because I am a sentimentalist, and I also have a very, very broad range of cultural interests. For example, you and I were rock and rollers today in, together in the hippie days, but I also like Al Jolson and Judy Garland and some of the pop stars that came before. When I was a program director of rock, I used to mix in pop and even punk. I like country music. I like old black and white movies. I like science fiction. So I'm a tough person to judge by, and I guess that sounds almost cliched because everybody thinks they are, but I really am. It's interesting, though, that you're talking about traditional entertainment in the month of December, because I have a theory about it, and let me bounce it off of you. I think a lot of the movies and a lot of the music that become very popular in December under the banner of holiday music and holiday movies and holiday entertainment really is part holiday, and I think it's also part an excuse to enjoy entertainment that's no longer considered hip the rest of the year.
That's pretty good, yeah, because you're right. Some of these movies and some of these things are so corny.
Mm-hmm.
They're very corny. They're very sentimental. They tug at your heartstrings.
Right.
And they probably would not go over very well if they were released today as brand new outings.
I wonder. However, and that's the whole key to it. Now, we're coming up on a break. Let's. We have a very interesting conversation coming up that has absolutely nothing to do with this. Carol Marx is going to be talking about a very different topic, and it's certainly of interest. When that's over, come on back, and let's talk more about this theory of ours about corny versus hip, and why we allow ourselves to be corny or old-fashioned during December. Richard Neer with us, folks. I'm Michael Harrison. Carol Marx is next. Rich will return right after that with more of this topic when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage, when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined again by the host of the program, Carol Marx. This time she's in conversation with Senator Ember Reichgott Young, a former Minnesota state senator and author of Minnesota's 1991 First in Nation Charter School Law, which was a winner of the 2000 Innovations in American Government Award from the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. Her new book is titled Zero Chance of Passage, The Pioneering Charter School Story, published by Beavers Pond Press.
What are chartered schools?
Well, charter schools are public schools. That's number one. They are public schools that are independent. So the opportunity exists for parents and teachers to come together and form a school for the children they wish to serve. One of the reasons why we created charter schools over 20 years ago is we wanted to provide more choices for children and families to access. Sometimes they don't exist in their neighborhoods. And so this gives them the opportunity to come together, and they agree to certain performance standards in order to do this school. So they get independence and autonomy in how they want it to look. And then in return, they must agree to certain performance standards in their contract or charter. So they trade regulation for results. And this allows them to take on new and interesting ideas in chartering and public education, like a longer school day, a longer school year, a focus on the arts, a focus on a particular special needs school, whatever they are interested in.
Now, I bet you also get asked this a lot. What's the difference between charter schools and other public schools? Because, of course, the other public schools are free, too.
They are, and they are both the public schools. There's charter public schools and district public schools. And the difference is this. It's that autonomy that is granted and that permission for them to have this charter. But in return for that, there is accountability, and the charter schools are held more accountable than district schools, because if they don't live up to those performance agreements in their contract or charter, they can be closed. A chartered public school can be closed. But that is not the case often with district public schools. So it's that accountability. They must live up to performance standards or they can be closed.
You know, charter schools are all about giving people more choice. But suppose you get a tremendous number of applicants to want to go to a particular charter school, you know, more than the school can handle. What do you do about that situation?
The laws require that they are selected by lottery, first come, first serve, with a few exceptions. Like, for example, if there's a sibling already attending that school, they would have a preference. Your point is very well taken, Carol, because right now on a national level, there are 1 million names of students on waiting lists for charter schools in this country. Overall, and just to give you a sense of how many are being served, about 2.3 million students are attending over 6,000 chartered schools in 42 states and the District of Columbia. And like I say, 1 million names are on waiting lists. So what that says is there's a lot of desire for these schools, and there's a lot of desire for more schools to be created. But sometimes what holds them back are myths about chartering, and there's opposition or controversy in certain states, and that's holding them back. But parents and choice, very popular here, and in fact, chartering is supported by nearly 70% of the American public today. And I just ask you, what
important.
Else is supported by 70%
no.
of the American public today?
That's so important. And another thing that I found a very positive statistics about was that although we don't have a tremendous proportion of charter schools in the country, the charter high schools are doing disproportionately well when it comes to their standings. And they've been, you know, really rated at the top by several publications, including U.S. News and World Report and The Washington Post. And, you know, I think that says it all.
I think so, too, and I appreciate that research you've done, because it is true that even though charter public students consist of only about 5% of the public school population, over a quarter of the high schools on those lists by U.S. News and World Report, Newsweek, et cetera, are chartered high schools. So they're much out of proportion to the 5% of public school students they serve.
Now, I wanted to address one of the things that you just mentioned, and that was one of the things holding charter schools back or from getting started are some of the myths. So what are they so we can talk about them?
Well, first of all, There's a feeling like, where did they come from? They must be a political agenda from the right or the left. And what I'm here to tell you is that the idea of chartering came from the middle. It was very much a bipartisan initiative. It came from a coalition of legislators in Minnesota, both a Republican and Democrat. In fact, it came through a majority of a Democratic legislature, and I am a Democrat. So, in fact, I'm a union-endorsed Democrat. So chartering was all about choices. It came from the middle of the political spectrum, and in fact came from the outside of the political spectrum, from a group of civic leaders who really laid out the template for this. They were just interested in improving public education. So really, it was not a political idea at all. It was simply about giving more choices and opportunities to our children. So that's a major thing that I think a lot of people don't realize in some states.
And I think to really give people the idea about how it got, you know, the ideas about charter school and what it was going to look like got started in such an interesting way, because you were at a conference and everybody was eating and they were trying to figure out, gee, what should this charter, you know, this new kind of a school look like? And then you wrote down all the suggestions on a napkin.
It's right. You are so right. We had an education reform conference up at a resort in northern Minnesota. And we had heard from some speakers, and I'll mention that in a moment, but we heard from some speakers, and that evening over a little wine and a great dinner, we decided that we would flesh out what a charter school would look like. So charter school legislation started on a dinner napkin. That is true. And one of the reasons why that occurred is because one of the speakers there was a man by the name of Al Shanker, who was the president of the American Federation of Teachers at the time, himself a reformer. He was one who actually suggested chartered schools to this education conference. He was looking at a way to professionalize the teaching profession. He wanted to give teachers the chance to be autonomous leaders in their classroom, to actually not only lead their classroom, but actually lead their schools as well. And he saw chartered schools as a way for teachers to have that professional autonomy. And so I, being a union-endorsed Democrat, thought that was a very powerful idea, and we sat down with other people around our table and started to lay out, as you say, the dinner napkin on chartering. Now, as it turns out, over the years, the unions have opposed chartering because they wanted it more within the district rather than outside the district. But we have always felt that having the charter outside the district causes the K-12 system to become more responsive. So that's the route that we went.
And so it just shows you that things can come full circle and things can change. Now, one of the things that there's been a big debate about in our country is really, you know, the private school vouchers. So let's talk about the value of charter public schools versus private school vouchers and how charter school vouchers either strengthen or weaken the public schools.
Well, the issue you raised was very, very critical to the emergence of chartering, because the reason it went nationally so quickly is because there was a very big debate on the national scene about private school vouchers. They were being proposed by President George H.W. Bush at the time. And there's very big difference between the two. Chartering is a public school choice. It is public school choice. It's about creating new and different and innovative schools. Private school vouchers are, of course, private schools, and they are basically a funding mechanism for existing private schools, so it doesn't necessarily cause new innovation or new autonomy within schools. And so it's very different. But the teachers' unions were very concerned that chartering would be the first step to vouchers. That has not been the case, and in fact it has come right down the middle as a centrist solution to education reform. And again, they are still public schools, and today I think the teacher unions realize that. I am a Democrat. I do not support private school vouchers myself, and so that, you know, hopefully gives a context to how chartering came to be.
That's former Minnesota State Senator Amber Reichgott Young in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled Zero Chance of Passage, The Pioneering Charter School Story, published by Beavers Pond Press. Richard Neer returns for more conversation. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison, the anchor chair, and returning as promised is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. And while Carol was conducting her interview, I've been thinking a lot about the subject we brought up, and the sound of the old-fashioned music and the look and the feel and the subject matter of the old-fashioned movies that are popular at Christmas. And I put forth the theory that maybe people just like that stuff, but they don't think to listen to it, or they don't know where to hear it, or they don't know where to see it. They don't make movies like that anymore. They don't make music like that anymore. Christmas radio stations that play Christmas music get huge ratings, playing Dean Martin, playing Frank Sinatra, playing Doris Day, playing old-time music. Maybe that kind of music would be popular all year if people gave it a chance. What do you think?
I don't think so.
Oh.
I think that people in the holiday season are it's the end of the year, they're nostalgic, they're looking back, they're surrounded hopefully by family and friends, and I think there's a certain sentimentality that they have now that they don't have pretty much the other 11 months of the year. And it allows them to reflect on a time that seemed more innocent. It may not have been more innocent, but, you know, when they were younger and they were kids and their parents would play Dean and Frank and Perry Como and all that stuff. But I don't know that they could take a regular diet of it 24/7, 365. What do you think?
I think they can. I think that I think there can be new Perry Comos. I think there can be new Frank Sinatras. I think there can be new Ray Conniff singers and choral music and sweet movies about the good guy winning in the end. And violence is not always necessary, that there doesn't always have to be a twist or an angle or an evil underpinning or a conspiracy. One of the things I find amazing watching the old movies from the 50s, 60s, and even the early 70s, watching them now, I say to myself, okay, when's the other shoe going to drop? And then I realize the other shoe never drops, that these people are who they seem to be.
Well, you know, the one guy that survived all this, and it survived because he's still alive, is Tony Bennett. Remember when Tony Bennett did the duets records?
Yes.
They sold very well.
Yep.
And Tony Bennett, whenever he releases something or he makes an appearance, always sells out and gets a huge crowd. So
yep.
He's the one guy who lived, survived into his 80s, and is still making music that people like.
It's funny that back when he was a star in his youth, he was considered a B-level Frank Sinatra. I remember when I was a kid, Tony Bennett was considered to be not in the top tier. He wasn't a Bing Crosby. He wasn't a Frank Sinatra. He was, you know, in that second tier. But since he's survived, and he always was very good, he's now an A-tier. It's
you know
of,
who
it's
I
sort
heard?
Of like in rock, Aerosmith. Do you remember back in the 70s, Aerosmith was considered this B-tier rock band from Boston.
Yeah, they were now they're Stones like, ripoff.
Right, exactly.
but you know who I heard the other day on one of the Christmas stations, and I heard it in high fidelity. I remember we used to hear those old cracky records. Who was great? Nat King Cole.
Oh, my gosh, was he a beautiful voice.
His voice, when you hear it with today's modern equipment, is incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no reason why music like that, and gosh, I don't want to sound like an old, you know, an old fogey, because we're not old fogies. I worked every day on the front line of modern music. We're in the trade publication business, so, you know, have to disclaim that. But there's no reason why people don't hear more Nat King Cole. This is forever. It's forever. That's a once-in-a-century voice. And we need to broaden our menu, especially for young people.
You know, we have Rod Stewart, Harry Connick Jr., who does the older stuff, and it's quite popular.
Yeah. To be continued, thank you so much. Very stimulating, certainly timely with the season and all of the culture that we experience in December, which is really very refreshing. Richard Neer, our senior correspondent, thank you. Thank you, Beverly Santanella, our producer on the front line. Thank you, Carol Marks, for putting this all together and hosting this program. Kevin Casey, Stephen Wiseman, the entire Touch of Grey family. I'm Michael Harrison. Wishing you, of course, the best season possible, and inviting you back next weekend for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.